Well, good morning or good afternoon or good lunchtime, wherever and whenever you're watching this. Okay, so today I have someone really exciting. I really want looking forward to talking to for a long time. I have Dr. Susan Flavin and I have Mark Weltonville. And you may have seen they've made some headlines recently because they recreated a 16th century beer. And basically to do that, they built a 16th century brewery. And a lot of the headlines, which maybe we'll get to later on in this, were about how everyone in the 16th century was completely legless and falling over. But that's not quite true, I think. So what we'll do, so I suppose a good place to start, we want to talk just through how the project came about, what was entailed in bringing it to fruition, basically, because there was an awful lot of very, very complicated and very, very kind of complex work involved in this. And maybe, Susan, we can start this overall. I think it's your project. So maybe you can start giving us an idea of what Food Cult is and where you then came up with the idea of looking at the brewery.
There's a Food Cult is a five-year project funded by the European Research Council, and it looks at diet and food culture in Ireland, broadly speaking. So we're trying to, I suppose, fill the gaps that are left by the historical record by bringing together archaeologists and other people interested in food to sort of deepen our understanding. So we're looking at things like isotope analysis of skeletons. We're looking at collating all of the archaeological evidence for the period. So bringing together archaeological reports from over 200 sites to see if we can look at the geography of food in this period, looking at things like lipid analysis of pots. And then one part of this was looking at one foodstuff in great detail. And to do that, we wanted to bring in sort of practice-based history, so recreating beer. And the reason that we chose beer was because of all the other foodstuffs, it's the one that really does leave a very good historical record in some contexts, because we have sort of evidence of how much was consumed, but also how much grain was used to make it, how much volume was produced as a result. So it lends itself to recreation in a way that other foods just don't, really. And also, of course, because it was so hugely central to diet in this period too. It's as important as bread as a foodstuff, as well as its cultural and social significance too. So it was a no-brainer, really, to start with beer.
Right. But did you know going in how complicated and how big this was going to be?
Mark's shaking his head because I was so naive in terms of what I thought that we were going to be doing. And really, really underestimated that, because I'm not a brewer, I'm a historian that was very interested in beer and I wanted to sort of understand it more. But once I started talking to Mark, I began to understand very quickly that it was a steep learning curve, but yeah, there was a lot to get it right. As I think we did as close as we could, there was a lot more work than I'd anticipated, for sure.
And Mark, you had experience, as you said, like maybe your background is you're a food historian.
I am, yeah. And over the decades, sadly, I've been involved in various recreations of different foodstuffs, dining styles, bringing to life either kitchens or dining rooms. And over the last, it's now 10 years, I got involved in historic drinks, starting in America, over there. And I started with whiskey down in Virginia. And in fact, I've just got back. I'm about 3 days back from making period whiskey in Virginia, using, again, same tools and techniques. That led on to brewing, because you can't make whiskey without a type of beer. It's a different sort of form nowadays, but it actually has a lot of close links in the past. That led me... People kept asking about beer and led me to a couple of recreations of colonial ales in East Coast America, which then got brought over here, looking at 18th century beer brewing in Britain. And then I had this random email from Dr. Flavin saying, oh, any chance we could do a Tudor brewery? To which I said exactly what you said at the introduction. We can make Tudor beer, but we need a Tudor brewery. Because with the recreations I've always worked on, the rules are very simple. The ingredients come in and they touch period equipment until they leave. They can be analysed scientifically, which I think people have seen in the papers and the films we've done. So we have a second team that are testing everything. But we as a team work solely with the equipment. Otherwise, It's when we get to programs like this and people ask questions and I say, oh no, we put it in a plastic bucket overnight. Well, that's just ruined the entire thing. So to give credibility to the work that we want to do and to make sure that people realize we're serious about our work, that's our simple rule. It comes in, it goes out as Tudor beer, and betwixt that, it touches Tudor equipment, which means you have to build the whole thing from pots and bowls and sticks and buckets, coppers and so on.
Yeah, Susan's kind of nodding and shaking at the same time at the thought.
Yeah, because I suppose one of the big challenges, and this was where Mark was just brilliant, because if he's got these networks that nobody else really has, so just to get all this technology together was a real chore. And you know, Mark had to work with the last, isn't that right, Mark? The last independent cooper in the UK to build those.
As far as we know, yeah. And he's now retired since we did the project. I'm now struggling for coopers.
Yeah, and the copper had to be made in Portugal because we couldn't find a coppersmith in the UK or Ireland to do that. So again, this kind of really highlighted the problem with sustainability and in terms of these heritage skills and traditions. So that building the brew house wasn't as straightforward as it could have been.
Okay. Well, maybe we can come back to the brew house a bit later, because maybe we should just start with what goes into it. I mean, let's. You have a good structure this on your website already. Like, so where did you, like, you started off with, you found a recipe, I think was where you went.
So we didn't work with recipes because I suppose one of the problems with recipes, it's like the copy of whatever you've got, Jamie Oliver and Nigella Lawson on your bookshelf, and you might have never ever used it. And that's the problem with recipes. They're aspirational. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's exactly what people did, especially with beer. So what we used were household accounts, actual records of what was produced on a given day at that institution, which is often, we found more detailed than recipes to a certain extent, because we actually know exactly what went in, but exactly what came out as well. And we also know that it was produced repeatedly over time, how it varies, so that we're not just getting a blip, we're producing something that we know was regularly actually produced and regularly consumed and who it's consumed by. So that's why we went for Dublin Castle as well, because we have those really great records. So we use brewing directions, obviously, as well, because we don't have directions on how they brewed it, but we followed the accounts rather than a recipe.
Okay, so you found these accounts in Dublin Castle, and that was, what was there, like, did you find just one account, or did you kind of select which beer you wanted most to taste, or what?
Yeah, there's a short run of accounts. They're in Northampton. They're from William Fitzwilliam's deputyship in Dublin Castle. There's a couple of accounts that are so detailed that tell you everything that's consumed on a given day, how much beer is consumed. And there are some then that have details of every brewing over the sort of every couple of weeks. Okay. So those were the ones that we went for. And we produced an ordinary beer because those accounts talk about ordinary beers and strong beers, but we can quantify and examine exactly how much is produced of each. So we know that ordinary beer, about 80% of everything they produce is this so-called ordinary beer. Only 20% less even is strong beer. And that we know is reserved to the Lord Deputy himself. So we wanted to understand what the servants are drinking, not what the elites are drinking. Yeah.
And this was like, they were producing this basically as wages.
They call it table beer as well. It's to be eaten with your, as part of your allowance of food per day.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So basically, it was instead of money that this was part of.
No, they get money as well.
Yeah. Okay.
They're housed. They're sort of living. They're living in the castle. So it's part of the meals that they receive.
Right. Right.
As well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that means you know exactly how much everybody got and.
We can we know how many, for example, we know how many pints were served relative to a certain number of messes of food, so we can estimate. We know how many people are on the payroll. We don't know how many guests are coming and going, but we can compare what we think with sort of what we know, for example, soldiers' rations, or what we know is going on at Christchurch Cathedral, and we can sort of estimate how much is consumed. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. All food and drink in the past, before we get before really about the 1830s, is anyone who dines anything better than a small cottage does so with what we would think of as a little buffet in front of them, a mini buffet that Susan referred to. It's called a mess. And you put the food on the table in front of a group of people, usually four, and they are allowed that much. And it will be measured out food and drink. But what we can never say is whether one person ate more, one wasn't, didn't bother, one only ever had one. All we know is what was actually allowed for them.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so then your estimate here was something like about 10 pints a day. So some people could actually have been drinking 20 and someone drinking none, but.
Yeah,
and then it evens out because this is over. This isn't on one occasion. This is kind of all the time. And we know from other, an Elizabethan soldier's ration is 8 pints per day. It doesn't mean that they always got it because they couldn't always produce that much beer. And there's a lot of grain shortages in that in the period. And we know that at Christchurch Cathedral, it could be very, very high because these are masons who are working for 10 hours a day hewing stone underwater. It's in some cases. So if they work very hard, they get more. But that's an extreme sort of example.
Yeah, we might come back to that towards the end because I think, if I'm right, the findings of how strong the beer was kind of were unexpected and that. So let's go back then to the, like, when you started this off, you decided you couldn't just, you obviously had to get the ingredients, which then turned out to also prove an awful lot harder than you expected.
And with ingredients, never forget water. That was the first thing I was working on.
Okay.
The water was beer brewed at Dublin Castle. Water is the ingredient that often gets overlooked in recreations. So we had Susan get some colleagues to test the aquifer under Dublin and get pH, calcium levels, and so on. And so the first thing I was doing was hunting for somewhere where we could recreate the water from that. Otherwise, again, if it was too acidic, not enough calcium. So we settled on a site in southern England because its water table, which happened to be the Portsmouth aquifer, matched very, very closely, same amount of calcium, same pH as the aquifer under Dublin Castle. The only difference was that there was a trace, it was less than 1% of chlorine that had got into modern water, even though it wasn't processed in the same way. And so we used inline filters to remove that. So the first ingredient that was important to me was, is the water right? Yeah, then I left all the rest to Susan.
This just emphasizes the length you went to because, brewers, they're regularly changing water and all. Like, you could easily have just thrown in different chemical mixes and stuff. And
it would not have been valid.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think that is just, like I said, it just emphasizes the effort that went into this.
There was part of the medieval water course still in existence where you can access it. And Ellen O'Carron, one of our postdoctoral researchers, had to put her wellies on and go and take some samples to see what we were dealing with. Yeah, so we were lucky. We were very fortunate that the water at the Weald and Dalen Museum was a close match.
Right.
I had four museums earmarked, one in the Black Country for heavy iron, one over on Essex side. So, yeah, we were going to tailor where we went to suit the water.
And then you had to find the grain and you had to find hops.
Yeah, so basically we went for bear barley because we have a lot of references to bear as the type of barley that's used for brewing specifically in sort of 16th and 17th century Ireland. It doesn't grow commercially. There are people trying to develop, trying to bring back heritage grains in Ireland at the moment, but it didn't when we were doing it grow commercially. So we went to Orkney and worked with the Agronomy Institute there. Peter Martin and John Wishart helped us to get some bear. And I suppose the point about that was that bear is a landrace barley. So it's got a very different, it grows very differently to modern barley. And that's has an impact on, for example, how much sugar it can produce or its nutritional value. It's not, of course, it's not exactly what was growing in 16th century Ireland because the whole point of a landrace that is different wherever you put it. So it would have been different, but we thought it was as close as we could get to what we needed to make that. And again, there's some archaeological evidence. Marion McClatchy on the project, our archaeobotanist, you'll see that in the documentary, looked at some grains under a microscope for us as well. They came from 16th, 17th century sites, and we can confirm that we think that's what was used as well. So we went to Orkney for that.
We also learned why you don't grow that anymore, because it's taught most heritage wheats and grains are tall. We've bred shorter and shorter and shorter because they blow down. So we lost, what, a whole year because it blew down. We lost about half a field in a storm.
We got some that was in storage. They kept it for us the next year. So yeah, we did well with that. And then we took that to Warminster Maltings because we wanted to again use a sort of a more traditional method of malting. Warminster is the oldest floor malting facility in the UK still. And then so the bear was sent to them when it was harvested, and they malted it. Big problem we had was that we couldn't get any heritage oats, and we tried very hard. We even tried growing some. Farmer at in Dublin grew some for us, but it didn't make a very good malt. So we abandoned that. We just didn't have enough. There's not enough research really on oats compared to barley. So we used oat malt that came from Warminster as well, but that's not a heritage one. So 50% of what we used was bear, and 50% was an oat, modern oat malt.
Yeah, I know when you kind of launched your video, which we can talk about as well, that you had Maurice Deasy there from Canvas talking about. I've had him on before talking, and it shocked me when I was talking to him, like the amount of effort it takes. You know that there are seed banks there, and no one outside of anybody who's using them realizes what they give you, four or five seeds, and that's it. Yep.
That's right. You'd be waiting a very long time to brew some beer if you have to start from scratch. Exactly.
Like you really have to be determined that you want it to work. So I mean, that brings up the oats. They were, I think if I remember correct, they were more specifically to the Irish beer, you think, than the beer that was in England, that was brewed in England.
We
get oats in northern English beers. Obviously, the way that grain works across any country is affected by the humidity and the growing conditions. So if you made a beer in the 15th or 16th century down in the south of England, where I am at the moment, I'd expect a proportion of wheat in there, 20-25% of wheat. They tend to do that. Then it goes to more barley, and then barley and rye. And then by the time you get into the north of England, where oats grow better, you're getting a lot more oats. So it's more the availability of the grains. And I was very pleased because one of the accounts that Susan had was that the English officers, who are probably used to London-based beers, weren't overly keen on the Dublin beer. They thought it was a bit sharp. Okay. And that's exactly the taste we got. So that made us very pleased.
You get these really negative descriptions of Irish beer and that, but the same soldiers, sort of, you know, in sort of Henry VIII's, soldiers were complaining about beer that was produced in the West Country as well, because that had more oats than that. So it depends. It's regional, you know. It's not necessarily just Irish. And remember, Mark, that Hugh Platt manuscript, there's a recipe written by an English courtier, and his beer has 50% oats. So it's not, you know, it's not completely, if there's fresh, you know, as well in terms of what's
it's produced. Identical today. Who doesn't argue over a northern pint in Britain compared with the southern one? So nothing has changed.
And the there's other things like the dietetic, the medical understandings of food changes over time. So you get descriptions sort of by physicians in the 17th century arguing that oats are healthier, and you know, oat beer is healthy. So again, lots of things influence what people drink and when. So Ireland's in the 16th century may be a bit different, but you know, there's a lot of fluency in that, really.
That just raises, sorry, one question, maybe a bit of a tangent, but the beer that you're brewing here, you said it was like Dublin cask. So this was not, it might not be representative. I mean, that was around the time, I'm trying to get my dates correct, like the English were still pretty much in the pale. They were there. So this was.
They were English brewers, weren't they, with Irish staff? Brewing for English soldiers. So again, that helped justify why you had an English brewer doing it.
You know, some of the other accounts, like at Christchurch, some of those beers were 100% oat malt, anywhere from sort of 50% up. So those would have been quite different again. We compared the strength of the beer produced at Dublin Castle with lots of other examples from recipes and accounts throughout the period in England to see where it sat, because we didn't want to produce something that was really strong because it is a castle. And what we got, we compared it, we found that it kind of came out in the middle. It's not very strong or very weak. So it was a good representation, even though it came from a castle, when we fitted in with lots of other recipes as well.
Right. So, yeah, so by then you had your water, you had your malt, and you had to get your hops, which also was a multi-year project. Oh.
And a very strange car park.
Yes, that was the one. You can tell that story, Mark. But yeah, we wanted to use Tallhurst hops because we worked with Peter Darby at the National Hops Collection in the UK. And we needed something that was representative of the Flemish hop from the 16th century. And this is what he decided was the best thing that we could use, because genetically it's very similar, and but the problem was that there was five plants in the whole of the UK. So there was three at Dorothy Hollenby's bushel of hops in Sussex, and there were two at the National Hops Collection. And so it took 3 years basically to collect some from their both harvests each year, and then freeze them and wait for the next harvest. And that was where we had a disaster, Mark. You remember there was a very hot summer.
Oh, yeah.
And they all died. And then there was the case during COVID where the shipment was accidentally sent to Dublin and then sent back to the UK, but to the wrong address. And Mark, what happened? What happened then?
Well, what ends up happening, of course, is that Susan ends up with this bundle of basically vacuum packed hops, which turns out to be a sort of square of green brick. And the only way she can get them to me is if we meet up in a service station car park, where there, at the moment there is some surveillance TV of the two of us passing what seem to be green vegetable blocks backwards and forwards between two cars. I'm surprised we're still here.
Yeah.
With the Tallhurst hops, I was very pleased. This time last year, last November, there's a biannual conference in Virginia called Ales Through the Ages. And I was speaking about this project after a man called Stan Hieronymus, who wrote the book Hops, in that series of yeast, hops, all the different pieces. And I was sat there with my fingers crossed going, he was talking about the new genetic surveys of hops, and I'm sat there going, don't debunk our hops, don't debunk our hops. And he makes a statement halfway through saying that, as far as I can tell, the oldest hop variety in England from its red vine is now called Tallhurst, because it's a later name. And there was a little yay from me at the back.
Yes, because the last batch that we actually harvested was the day before Mark had just started brewing. And I went with the film crew, because we were filming at the same time, to Kent to meet Peter Darby and actually helped pick them. But that was the day before, so we were literally racing them down then to the museum. It was exactly at the right time, just before when they were ready, because you've got a really small, short window of time to actually harvest them. Right. So yeah, those were the sorts of frantic journeys we had to make.
So how many years was it from your actual, we're going on this to...
I think you contacted me in 19, and we brewed in 21.
1921.
Two years ago.
Yeah, I was probably looking for stuff before that, though. You know, so
you would have been hunting, but yeah, you contacted me.
A couple years more. I mean, a lot more work had gone into this in the years before as well, because I was working on those accounts for a long time, and before we got funding and that. So yeah, it was years in total.
Right, and it all came down to trying to rush this bundle of hops up.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
God Almighty. Yeah, I could imagine, like, if they flew away or something, the whole thing. Oh, okay. So then you have everything. We didn't touch on yeast. Mark's disappeared. Hopefully he'll come back. We didn't touch on yeast yet. You also had to try and recreate. I mean,
So we contacted John Morrissey, who's a microbiologist at UCC, and told him what we were trying to do, and asked him if he could do some research and come up with something viable for us to use. And then that was down to sort of genome science and molecular archaeology. They can sort of identify the closest living relative to the sort of earliest strain of beer yeast. And a couple of candidates were found. John worked with the National Yeast Collection in the UK, and a couple of candidates were found, and then they were sort of revitalized in the lab. There were some fermentation tests done to see if any of them would actually work. Some of them had history, so they were deposited in the early 20th century, because as you know, there's no pure yeast cultures before the 1880s. So these were deposited sort of then, and this one had a history of being used. It had been used in tests before. So yeah, it worked well. And John came over then to the museum with the yeast and inoculated the first brew for us, which is nice as well.
So as you say, this is, I don't know whether we should bring it up here, but yeah, let's talk like the yeast. This was a pure strain yeast, whereas, again, you don't know back in the day when they were doing this, they didn't have pure strain, so they were
exactly
lifting yeast.
And this and what John sort of said about exactly, they didn't have any pure cultures of yeast, but we are still working in the 16th century in Ireland. We know that these brewers are purchasing yeast, and they're paying a lot of money for it.
Right.
So we think that this is a sort of evidence of, you know, the beginning of standardization. They've already selected yeasts that are working very well, and there's some element of standardization.
Yeah.
And even though these batches would have been mixed to some extent, one yeast will dominate. And so we're not, you know, we were happy enough with that. And we know, I suppose, one thing, we did this, we worked over a couple of weeks at the museum. If we'd been doing this for months, then we'd have to think about contamination from, you know, external yeasts. And if we did this again, we'd want to do, you know, we'd want to look at that, sort of do more fermentation studies to see what the impact of that more open sort of brewing is. But we were happy that because we were brewing over a short period of time, that this was, you know, it was sufficient for the project. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make, that just because they weren't able to isolate yeast back then, it could still have been a single strain that, like you said, had been harvested and it had come down to being, they were using a single strain that wasn't necessarily a complex mix of yeast. So.
Yeah, and there's
I disappeared there for a minute.
Yeah, we were talking about yeast. You probably disappeared at a good time, actually. Yeah, but I suppose the other thing is that we shouldn't assume that, you know, this idea that it would definitely being contaminated because they didn't know how to keep their vessels clean and all that. Mark, there's no, I think brewers aren't as primitive in this period as we think. As
no,
people think.
We always point out when we're speaking to people that we've had 170 years of Pasteur scientific brewing, which is very good because we know the science of what's happened, but we've got 9,000 years of brewing before that. So somebody knew what they were doing. I'm writing about it at the moment, the fact that craft is in fact another word for science. But you might not notice that.
Yeah.
And the techniques that you're given by those who teach you are scientific, but they are just explained in a different and sometimes simpler way. And I can't think of any brewery instructions that don't always start with scald your equipment, boil some water, run boiling water through everything, your paddles, the whole lot. They just scald it. It's always considered very, very important. They're only going to have wild yeasts if they want them. It's as simple as that. If they want the sour taste of a Brett yeast, then that's what they'll be getting. If they don't, they're very keen on using barm and or dried yeasts, the yeast that you know works for your beer.
And they really don't want sour beer. If there's ever any complaining
dietetic
about
it, beer, it's sour is off.
Sour is not good. Yeah.
No, it's the argument I have when talking in the same programs about bakery, and everyone says, "Oh, they must have loved sourdough in the past." No, they do not, because sour means off. Sour means something's going bad.
So it is completely a more modern thing to like sour. Okay, that is not something I knew. Susan, before we started, I mean, we were talking about the Norwegian farmhouse brewing as that this is not the same thing. And that comes in, but that does make the same point that you're making, that like they know how they're farmhouse brewers. They don't know they don't know necessarily what they have, but they have this yeast that they've isolated in practice over centuries. And so they're able to keep that pure and just reuse it.
Yeah, that idea of the Krieg ring has become very popular of late. It's a very interesting style, and I get a lot of questions about it, saying, you know, we must have done that here. Well, there's no evidence for anything of that sort, because each region is like suggesting that Spanish beer should taste like British beer. Of course it shouldn't, the tradition thing. But I do have, as I knew this might come up, I've got a little section from a book called The London Art of Cookery and Housekeeping by a man called Farley. He publishes that in 1780s. things don't get written down very early. A big problem with brewing is every century you go back, they write less, partly because just nobody's writing it down, and partly because brewing, like many other things, are trades. And I don't tell you how to do it, because then you'll do it, unless you in my trade. So you've got two sides to the problem: a lack of literacy. Well, no, brewers don't write books. So a lot of the things that get written down in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century are pretty likely to have been standard practice for centuries. You tend to get information when there's a new thing comes in. They always mention how this new idea has come along. And Mr. Farley mentions, and I've got it here, it is the practice in some places of remote towns to dip whisks into their yeast. So these are bundle of stick whisks, usually willow, bound together. It's what I use for making omelets. And then they beat it well. So they're beating their yeast with these little whisks. And then so when they're finished, they hang up the whisks and the yeast on them will dry. And if there is no brewing for 2 months afterwards, these whisks will be brought back in to whisk up with a little flour. So we have something similar, but not the same. So we're definitely storing yeast. Another late 16th century account talks about how when you're brewing towards the end of the year and it's starting to get too cold for fermentation, that you should take your foam, as they call the yeast off the top, and paint a little on the inside of a wooden bowl. So it always has to be a wooden bowl, never a pottery one. So it's got the same, something about the wood is the same as the Kriegring is being discovered. Right. That bowl gets painted on every time we brew for a month and then left in the corner of a dry room upside down, lest dust enter it. So they don't want dust in there. And then in March, when it's warm enough to ferment again, you're supposed to put a little cold water and flour in there and off she goes again. So we have parallel traditions, but not the same.
Right. So even though they didn't know what it was, they didn't know it was a cell, they didn't know it was like, they knew there was something there. But
closest I've ever got to anyone getting it is a man called William Ellis, quite a famous book, The London and Country Brewer. And he considers that yeast might digest the concoction that you've made. So he's getting very close.
But anyway, but whatever, whether they understood or not, they knew the practice of the
ability. They knew how to do it.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, so I think we've got to the point now where you have all your ingredients, you've been rushing them there. Somewhere before you rush that final lot of hops, you had to then build the brewery to rush it too.
Yeah.
So, actually, what I'll do, I mean, this on its own was, I'm not sure where you started with it.
I suppose for me, I'm just like any researcher, when Susan and I get him a job, you've already got an idea to where to go. That's why you employ, you've got an entire lifetime framework. And I'd been working on slightly later breweries, so I had a basic idea that we're going to need a boiling copper to boil the water and then boil the wort. We're going to need a coopered vessel. From all the illustrations show them coopered. So a coopered mash vat. Okay. So you're going to need that. You're going to need something to move hot liquor about. So that's a mixture of buckets, and they describe something they call lets, which are large ladles. Okay. So you'll need those. A lot of it is just thinking, well, I need a jug to put the yeast in. So I'll need a 16th century jug remade. I'll need a pot to put this in. I'll need a bushel measure to measure my grain. So find some, then you get all of the not problems, but the considerations, the slight stumbling blocks. Without a good cooper, and Les Skinner was a very good cooper, you need someone who go, when I phoned him and said, I need a new mash vat, he immediately said, how much is going in it? About 50 gallons, 45 gallons. And he immediately told me how thick the wood needed to be to take the strain of that amount of hot wood. All that will be need to be nearly just over an inch thick. It mustn't be too tall or too squat because it won't work. That's somebody else's experience coming to the fore in that. You get little problems because when I just said a minute ago, we needed a bushel measure to measure out our two bushels of grain. Well, the next question has to be, how big is a 16th century bushel? Because it is not the bushel that you would buy if you went to a farmer's market. You can buy a plastic bushel measure, but that is not it. So there's research on every level of it. And if you and your audience are brewers, we've missed one massive problem that we had to overcome with some maths, is no one ever starts a brew with the end point. They start with a mash bill, and you mix water called liquor in with it, and eventually you get, if you're home brewing, 25 pints, 40 gallons, whatever.
Yeah.
No one likes to start with the end result, which is what Susan gave us.
All
Because that doesn't account for how much liquor you put in at the start. And that took a lot of research. And that was a couple of, one of them was this courtier that Susan mentioned, Hugh Platt, happens in an unpublished manuscript. It didn't make it into any of his books. He mentions how many gallons of water you'll need to make this much beer, which
Okay.
is absolutely fantastic. And there are a couple of other ones later which back this up. A chap called, he calls himself a gentleman, but it turns out to be Mr. Whittaker. And he gives the proportions necessary of liquor to make so much beer. And that kept coming out at approximately 5 to 3.
Okay.
So 5 gallons of liquor in the initial cauldron will give you about 3 gallons of beer at the end. And without coming across pieces like that, we would have been floundering because where do
Okay.
you start?
Yeah, so I suppose this is something I mentioned to Susan as well earlier, like not being a historian, you kind of have this idea that there's lots of knowledge. It's 500 years old, but they were writing then. Shakespeare was around, like that there was writing. You don't realize how little there actually is and how much you have to piece together.
If anyone here has ever had a magazine article written about them, and I'm sure most of us have, you'll know exactly what most of the brewing accounts that we were dealing with are. They're magazine articles. They're written by educated, wealthy people who have time to write and publish, who have gone to see a brewer, sat down, made notes, and then written it up later,
Right.
either omitting things, putting things in the wrong order, or misunderstanding slightly. That's one of your big problems. One of the first descriptions of how to brew in the 16th century is a man called John Caius, from who goes on to found Caius College in Cambridge. He writes a dietetic book. It's all about health, and it includes instructions for brewing ale and beer. And he goes all through the process, and he says, and that's how you brew ale. And now to brew beer, you change the group for hops. But if you read backwards, he's missed out the group from the others. So he's just come, you're now left wondering, well, how much of this is actually correct? Your
Right.
next problem is when I'm teaching. If you anyone came out to the little breweries I'm in, and I've just been teaching distilling, I will say I can teach you the process, I can't teach you the craft.
And then there's the problem
Because
of
the craft
interpreting
will
those,
come.
the inter interpreting those instructions as well. So if it tells you to boil the water and then let it cool until you can see your face in the water, those sort of sensory descriptions, we were
Yes.
trying to follow those because we didn't go in with a certain temperature in mind. We wanted to actually recreate what they did. But we were all standing around the sort of the cover looking to see if we can see our faces. If we
Facing
can
it.
see our face, well, I can see my face. So that must be, and that's problematic because it took us a while then to sort
Yeah.
of, figure out. One day
And
we did
the
have
thing with
water too hot. Yeah, so
craft is it only I can write down the process of making 16th, 17th or 18th century beer for you. And then when we do it, something will happen, and you'll look over and say, "Well, why did you do that?" And it'll be 8 reasons. Well, you didn't write that down. Well, it doesn't normally happen like that. It's that ebbing and flowing of craftsmanship. It's that I got it when my first 18th century brews in America. I'd been brewing with this guy for 4 years. He glanced into the mash vat and said, "Could you put 2 more gallons of hot water in there?" And I said, "Yep, certainly." Why? He said, "Oh, the grain bed's not floating properly." We've never done that before. And he said, well, it's never happened before. So you would never write that down. And that's what when I suddenly got this understanding that we can take these instructions and repeat them and repeat them, but we will also learn from doing it little bits that I just don't even notice perhaps. But there are these clues, as Susan alluded to there. There's the instruction of how hot the water needs to be to go on the mash. They realize that, which then led to a question, well, why do they boil it if they don't need it that hot? If they only need it to be hot enough to cook the grains, which we now know is somewhere around the sort of 65, 70 Celsius, why don't you do that? Well, in a pre-thermometer world, you can't tell how hot water is till it's boiled.
Okay, so you had
That's
to
your first
go.
visual clue, is you've got high enough, now come down. And
Okay.
also, if you're following the scalding instructions, once it's boiling, you then clean your equipment with the first couple of gallons off the top then you rake the farm. It all starts to make sense as you start following those instructions.
Yeah. So I mean, there's actually I have one question here that So your process that you followed was you boiled the water, you then let it cool down, and until you could see your face in it, and that was your point at which you. And
it's very close. It's within about 2 degrees of most modern brewers pitching. It's about right.
And then from there we put the water in on the grains.
There are lots of different instructions. There are literally hundreds of different ways, and they're all very, very similar, but everyone's got their little, don't do this for 10 minutes. Someone else says do it for an hour, but the process is fairly constant that you pour water into the mash vat first to get a little at the bottom. You start adding your grains continuously. You have someone with a paddle rowing, they call it rowing, and that person with the paddle rows so that there will become no clogs or lumps, as they put it. So keeping a consistent mix. You add your grains, you add your hot water, and then it, again, quite keen on the fact, you leave it, you cap it, you put some more grain on the top to keep the heat in, and then you put a lid of some form on top, and you walk away for an unspecified amount of time, which varies from brewer to brewer, but usually is somewhere between an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Okay. Let me see if this.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Right. That should have been that you were able to hear everybody, but I did something wrong. But that was the brewery.
That was the brewery. You could see the fermenting vessels in the front. You could see the copper kettle, the mash tun, and the under, and the buck next to it, which is just a storage container, and the bushel measure on the bench there. So most of the stuff was there.
I'll try to do this once more with us able to talk, but not seen.
We can hear you now.
Okay, now we can hear each other, so now we can talk.
Right, you've got the ferment. I was right. The fermenting, open fermenters in front of us, and then a table next to it, a bench with the bushel measure, some buckets on the floor, the 50-gallon copper cooking away in the background there, and then the two tall vessels. One is the mash vat, and one is the buck.
Right.
A buck is just a storage vessel. Right. So it's where you put your wort, because you haven't got two kettles, because we don't have a commercial brewery.
Okay.
The hourglass is there as well, Mark.
And there's an hourglass on the table, because someone should say, how do you know it's an hour and a half? Well, there we are.
Yeah, and that, again, like, it's just down to the kind of the detail in this, that you didn't use a clock, you went and built an hourglass. I mean,
yeah, and sadly, our poor little woodworker, Robert, I didn't just ask him to build an hourglass. I got him designs for the one on the Mary Rose, which apparently was an absolute pig to make.
I should say as well that the bushel that you could see there, because in Ireland there were, as elsewhere, there were lots of different sized bushels, and that could have been a really big stumbling block. But we were very fortunate. One other reason for using the Dublin Castle accounts was that they were using the standard Winchester bushel, so we knew we could recreate that. Whereas if it was some regional size, we wouldn't have a hope, and that could make a huge difference.
Right. And then you
had the bushel. Luckily for me, that was a different cooper. The Winchester bushel is the one they took to America, and is still the American Imperial bushel, is the English Winchester. So I went to the cooperage at Jamestown. I know the cooper there, and I just said, make me a bushel, and he already had the patterns. My problem was I had to bring that on over my plate for me.
And then, sorry, I'll just keep going. Then you also had, let me go this back again.
Oh, yes.
I'm just reading some more about those the other day, yesterday. Another description of a woven mesh that keeps your grains back. The wooden peg there is a tap before you have the turning spigots. And Susan came to me with some of the orders for Dublin Castle that talked about taps and canals, which is pipes. So the pipe is the thick bit, and the tap is the little peg that goes into it. So it's a very simple way of draining a tub or a bucket or whatever. And you may have come across very good beer historian Martin Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to Martin, I was mentioning how we were going to probably use the system, which was very common in the Middle Ages and Tudor times, of having something called a long tap. It's a it's the hole is in the middle of the base of your mash vat, and you have this long stick that sticks into it and you
Right.
can lift it up. That was common. And he was asking about where were we working south of England, and with equipment coming from there. And it was he that said, well, there's a very good chance that they're using this system. And that married with the accounts that Susan had got for the orders of small taps and channels. And what goes behind that is this woven wicker basket called a wilch.
Right.
It is always described as a sieve. So the wilch goes inside your tub, the tap sticks out. When you pull the peg out, the wort runs clear without any grains in it. I got quite excited thinking that the gaps in the wilch needed to be about an eighth of an inch, which is about the size of a swollen grain. I got sort of stupidly obsessed with that. I'm now pretty confident that what the wilch does is actually create a void behind the end of the tap, just allowing the water to flow in freely.
Okay.
I don't think it sieves in quite the way that everybody thinks. I
Okay.
think scientifically it's slightly different.
Right. Okay, that's interesting. So yeah, so then you had all this, you got it all. I mean, I think it's obvious the amount of effort that went into just getting this right. And you know, there is no doubt, I think, to anybody who's watching this that this is as close as you could possibly be to a 16th century beer, because it is just, you know,
Yeah,
you
we're
every
even in a 16th century building, sadly.
yeah, you're also in the building. So but this brewery, I think, is around 28 gallons, is it? Or am I?
40. The copper holds 50,
Okay.
and we were doing two washes of in the 40s. We're
Okay.
trying. The aim was to do a barrel a day, a 36-gallon barrel a day.
I'm just wondering how that relates to the Dublin Castle, because they were
Smaller.
doing
It
600.
was scaled back, yeah. They were producing around 207,000 pints a year. So it's much bigger than what we were doing. Yeah, it wouldn't have been feasible to do
Yeah,
that.
but you.
We'd have had a lot of beer to dispose of otherwise. So yeah, we had to scale back.
I settled on a barrel because, having done previous experiments, I don't like going below that because it messes around with the flavor profiles, especially if you're using herbs and so on. Once you start getting too far down, if you just halve everything and keep going down, once you get below about a barrel of finished product, you will find that some of the herbs are more predominant because
Okay.
they become stronger at smaller amounts. So really don't like going below a barrel.
Right. I just wondered about, but I mean, you're confident, or as confident as you can be, that this is, they would have been using the same setup in Dublin Castle. It's not the way.
The difference would have probably been that it's permanent, and this equipment we built there, the vats are slightly smaller, but would all be the same. The main difference is if you build a brewery, not a farmhouse brewery, which is what we made, then the coppers are built in
Okay.
into stonework. And because ours was a farmhouse one, that can be moved out of the hearth. So that was the main difference. And I don't know if does the brewery survive at the castle, or is it long, long gone?
No, it doesn't
Yeah,
survive.
I would expect one making the amount of beer that the accounts put forward to have had a double copper. So
Okay.
you've always got one for liquor being warmed up and a second one for cooking wort,
Okay.
rather than having to share one.
Okay, I guess, sorry, just one point is like, would there, I guess what I was getting at is, would they have been using just simply bigger equipment, or would they have had more of roughly the same
No,
size?
both bigger. You're stuck, and I can't remember the proportions. Put me on the head. You're stuck with coopered vessels to a maximum size. If you
Yeah.
want to know how big coopered vessels mustn't be, look up the Great London Beer Flood, because they made them too big and they split.
Okay.
Also, we did aftermarket build the brew house. Charlie Tavernier, our researcher, did come across Henry VIII's those inventories for the towns of Portsmouth for the
Yes.
breweries, and they were really, really similar to what we'd built, so we were
Yeah,
really quite relieved about that as well.
there was four Portsmouth that supplied his navy and possibly others at the area where the Mary Rose, the historic dockyard, is now. There were four named breweries up in one corner. We've got pictures of them. I can only remember one was the Rose, one was the Lion. Each one has a name. And the contents of them were virtually identical to the equipment. There was the rowing paddles. There was the woven filters, which they refer to as stoop morns. It takes a lot of pulling the language apart. There was the buckets, the bucks. There were certain buckets which they seemed to reserve for yeast. There was 24 buckets in each one, which are only for yeast. So they're back to this keeping your yeast clean and not using other things. And the other one that was interesting is each brewery had its own little mill for milling the grain again, so that the grain is milled just prior to brewing, not milled elsewhere. So, yes, it really helped back up everything that we knew and the things we didn't know.
Right. Yeah, we should have said that. I mean, we missed that part of the process that obviously we had to mill this. That was complicated as well. They wouldn't have by hand. They would have used a water mill in Dublin. But we didn't have a water mill, or at least not one that we could say was definitely the right. There were problems as well, Mark, where they were using. There was a water mill at the Wealdon Downland Museum, but it's not easy to just use them in terms of cleaning the stones afterwards.
And things cleaning like that. Millstones. People don't realise that you need a malt mill, not a flour mill, because the enzymes in malt will, if you grind malt in a flour mill, and don't actually remove and bleach the stones afterwards, a job I've done once and don't want to do again. The enzymes in the malt will continue to convert the flour that you then make from then on, and nobody's bread will rise. So they will have kept malt milling completely separate from flour milling.
Okay. Yeah. So we know some people did still, even at castles in Ireland, there's evidence for quarrens for malts.
And the famous English one, John Harrison, who writes his description of England in the same decade as our one, he goes on to mention, and my wife uses a quern to mill all our malt. So it's obviously not an uncommon practice. Right. He shouldn't write that down because he's not an official brewer, and therefore he's evading tax doing that. He's being naughty boy.
Yeah, we did that by hand, which was very very labour intensive.
Luckily,
not a task that I would like to do again.
But at the end of all of this, then you ended up with your beer. Let's get to that.
Yes.
So, am I right that it surprised you in how strong it was? That you expected it to be?
It didn't surprise me. I was pretty sure it was going to be.
Okay.
Having worked on earlier ones and later ones, I was expecting it to come out in right in the middle, 5-6%. And so was justified. I'd been spending a lot of time saying that a beer is as strong as I want to make it. There is nothing wrong with the equipment in the past to produce a beer or an ale of anything from 10 or 11% right down to a harvest drink if you want. It's down to how many washes you do of the grain, how you store it. There's no reason why it wasn't. And that for me was a good justification of what we got.
Right. And that is so that is what you would think that this standard beer that they were giving as wages it was around 5 or 6%.
Yes, for table beer.
That institution in that year, because again, this is the variability we don't know. I mean, we have comparative institutions in Dublin, and we will know how much malt they used, but we don't know what they produced from it at the end, and that's why this is very special. So we don't know. We can say at this institution, this is a snapshot of what could be produced and what we know was produced, but we can't make big assumptions about what everybody else was drinking at the time. So again, it seems that this we've compared this to lots of other accounts, and this sits somewhere in the middle. It's a sort of a middling ordinary beer that we know was produced all over Europe at that time at that strength. So we can say that we don't know, at an individual institution, given the variabilities as well, what they drank. So we have to be really careful about not over sort of emphasizing the significance of the results. All we can do is look at a snapshot and in the most detail.
And like you said, I mean, so much of it depends on craft, that if you had a different person that day, there might have been a bit more, and the harvest would be slightly different.
So
it would vary.
And within my accounts that I've read, they get it wrong too. You often see in a household account, just the words beer failed.
Yeah.
So it didn't work that time. Something either a stuck fermentation or something got in, and then you get the same line in another one. It just says malt failed. And so it wasn't a perfect bucolic past. They got it. It went wrong for them too. And so, yeah, this snapshot is quite important. We can do. With the amount of beer, though, it seems like an awful lot of beer until you think about it carefully. Apart from the fact it's a food. And if you talk to anyone or read from even the 1920s, beer is used before they go out into the fields as an energy drink. Human beings habitualize to alcohol very easily. And you only really in Britain have to go back to the 1970s before drinking and driving was really an issue. Most workmen, builders would go, you know, work all morning, go to the pub, have a couple of pints with their lunch, have a couple on their way home with their friends, go and have their supper at home, and then go out for a beer. So easily having 7, 8, 9, and then you get the accounts where they're saying, oh, you know, I go out on a Friday night, I have to go into double figures to feel it. We forget that this is a very recent thing.
Yeah, and one interesting point, Mark Halewood, who's sort of beer historian, I spoke to him recently, and we were talking about this at another seminar, and what he said, and it's important, is that if we're talking about sort of laborers in a field, and that they're not necessarily drinking this beer all year round either, there's certain times of the year where you're going to drink more, so it's not every day, presumably, but there are times of the year where you're drinking very heavily for work. So again, there's that seasonality and variability in terms of what people are drinking as well. And of course, the other thing is that this is what you're consuming for work during the day. We've no way of quantifying what's consumed in an alehouse after hours. Again, no. Leisure drinking is on top of this.
our engineering gopher Adrian that worked with us, who has a craft background and is a blacksmith actually, which helps. We grew up on the Suffolk Fens and learnt to scythe. With the last old boys that could scythe the field where a tractor couldn't get in. And he said, after you'd set up your scythe, you had a couple of pints of beer before you went and exerted yourself. And he said, you didn't feel drunk. You just used the pure carbohydrate, the energy out of that, as almost like filling a fuel tank. So it's completely different to the English idea of binge, you know, going out for beer. We need to think more of the European habit of having a lot of alcohol spread out all day through your dining, not going out for 8 pints and falling over. It's different.
Yeah. It actually raises one question for me there. I mean, I know, Susan, we mentioned earlier, and you're emphasizing that this is not, you know, that this, you've seen it compared to Norwegian farmhouse brewing as referred to now, and this is not that. But what I was asking at the time, and the reason it came up was this kind of brewing in this brewery, was this a transition period between kind of farmhouse brewing and commercial brewing? And I guess what I'm getting at the end of the day is why, you know, the farmhouse brewers in Norway, that they don't boil the wort, so it's what they call a raw ale, which has a lot more protein in it, which would match up with the food concept.
Every instruction I have where it describes making hopped ale has a boil in it.
Okay.
Always talked about boiling the wort, moving the wort back to the kettle or into another kettle, adding the hops. It varies. Sometimes they put a little hops in. I was reading one this morning because I thought you'd be asking this, and it tells you to boil, make sure the wort is at a rolling boil, and then put the hops in, which is what we did. That's very common. And then they argue, do you boil it for 1 hour, 2 hours? 2.5 hours, 10 minutes. Mr. Ellis, who seems to be in the 1730s, trying to unpick the science, he says you only need to boil it until it separates, till it cracks, it curdles, as he says it. And he keeps telling you to pull out a bowl and look and see whether it's actually a coagulation. It's breaking down the long chain proteins and starting the fining process. You can see it with these swirls.
Yeah.
And he says once it does that, you're fine. Because for some reason, someone had already worked out early in the hop brewing process that you need to boil for longer than sterilization. It's nothing to do with that. Otherwise, we'd bring it to the boil and stop because they'd quickly find. Because, again, we forget that fuel is money.
Yeah.
Every log you burn costs money. Every 18th century distilling recipe I have has a bit at the bottom for what they call coals, how much it's going to cost you in fuel. Same as today with people worrying about fuel. So they're not going to boil the wort unnecessarily. There is there is this protein breakdown that needs quite a lot of boiling, and someone has established that long before they're writing it down.
No, I was kind of wondering whether...
You don't need to do it with Groot.
Also, I mean, the thing is, I don't know if we should be comparing Norway and Ireland in those terms anyway, because, again, we don't have that much evidence of brewing at farmhouses in Ireland, because, I mean, in terms of the cost, it wouldn't really be viable either. And Ireland in the 16th century is a very dairying culture. We've got a lot of evidence that milk products are consumed a lot in rural areas. Beer and ale seem to be more urban drinks or associated with bigger institutions where it's provided. There's no evidence that people regularly brewed at small sort of isolated farmhouse locations. It may well be the case, but we're not finding lots of evidence for that. So it would be an assumption to think that everybody in small farmhouses were brewing for themselves. The evidence that when they go into towns, the English write the Gaelic Irish get very drunk when they go into towns and frequent an alehouse and those kinds of stereotypes. But there's not really... elites in big houses in Gaelic Ireland drank a lot of wine as well, because there's very big trade links with Spain and that and other drinks and of course milk and that. So we don't know really much about rural brewing. So I don't think a direct comparison is useful in that regard.
Yeah, no, I guess I was just kind of coming around when you were referring to it as food and energy, that, you know, the proteins in an unboiled one are still there, and that would be
people would have thought. We don't boil our pre-hopped ales when that term is a separation, because of the, but we don't use the same herbs as Europe.
Right.
Europe uses more bog myrtle, England uses more ale hoof and cosmary. So basically it depends on which bittering herb you favor, process. You can't discount household brewing in Britain until the mid 19th century.
Okay.
It's the railways. Once you build railways, you can get good commercially made beer to every part of Britain cheaper than I can make it.
Right. Yeah.
Prior to that, it's often cheaper to make it in your farmhouse or in your area.
Right. And that is what I suppose essentially what like you said, for all your efforts to produce the same ingredients, they would have gotten them very locally, and that would have varied by year, by harvest, everything.
I don't know, does barley grow in Ireland, Susan? Because that's England.
Yeah.
Or is it England?
No, it does. Yeah, it does. But more oats. So, and this is something we're looking at with the archaeological database now. So we're literally plotting. We're looking at all the evidence we can find for cereal drying kilns. So we're looking at what's turning up in those and if there's a geographical distinction. Some sites at houses in Ireland, like at Carrick Mines, which we're looking at, we've got... On the one side, we've got evidence of specialization. So one building is really associated with barley and one is really associated with oats. So even at that one sort of castle, we can see that there's something going on, maybe malting on the one hand and then baking or grains for another reason on the other hand. So we're trying to untangle, again, complicate this idea that Ireland is all oats and there's no barley. But we can look at that now in detail by sort of mapping it to see where, you know, what context we're finding different things in.
Okay, so listen, I've held you for an hour, so maybe we'll start to wrap. I know you'd all be very busy, but let me just ask. So, where do you go next with this? It's a 5-year project. It sounds like you're around year four, so you've another year to.
No, we're now we're five. Yeah, this is five in February. Yeah, so we're basically at the moment. There's just a rush on to write up everything that we've. Charlie and I are writing a book about food culture in Ireland. Beer is one part of one, every chapter is kind of driven by a food type. So beer is one aspect of that. We have published the paper on the brewing project already. That's open access if anybody wants to read it. It's in the historical journal. The documentary will be freely available soon. So if anybody wants to just check the website, that's where we put links to everything.
So here actually for
There's still so much work to do. A huge amount of data has been generated through all the archaeology and the skeletal analysis and everything. So the first thing is to kind of write all that up first, and then worry about the next project.
And do you think anyone else will undertake or be mad enough to undertake a project as detailed?
I hope so. I hope that we get to have another go. I think we could do with generating more data for what we've done already. Like variations, and I'm steeling myself at the moment for the fact that really, really, we are going to have to build a wood-fired malt house. to continue these projects any further, not just with tuna drinking, but right across the board of anything before coal entered the malt house. I've just spent the last 3 weeks trying to discuss why I don't want to do it and kept coming up with the answer is yes, you do. So
I was wondering when you said stealing yourself, it looked more like you were looking forward to this, not...
I've just spent 3 weeks stoking fires. I need a little breath, a little rest. You can hear it in my voice. It sounds like I belong to a cigar club.
we lost connection with Susan. I don't know whether we should wait a second or two, see if she comes back, but we'll just be saying goodbye anyway, I guess.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
Yeah, thanks a million for taking the time. Unfortunately, like I said, Susan got disconnected. We're not sure, so I won't wait for her. And I just say, thanks to Susan. Thanks to you, Mark.
I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, hopefully when you have your malt house fired up. It was a fascinating project, really detailed. And just fascinating what came out of it. What you can learn from going into that depth that you just cannot do kind of theoretically, you know?
Yeah.
So I enjoyed talking about it, and hopefully when this goes out, people will enjoy listening.
We can always come back on and answer questions if it goes that way.
Perfect. That would be, no I will hold you to that. All right.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Goodbye, everybody.
Sorry.
She's back and gone.
Yeah, we're
waving goodbye now.
Fine, sorry that I couldn't get back in.
No problem. Listen, Susan, I'll just repeat. So I'm just saying thanks, look, for taking the time to come and talk to me. It was a fascinating project. And like I said to Mark there, it's stuff that you cannot do theoretically. It really does need this hands-on making stuff work to learn. And I'm sure we've only touched on a tiny fraction of it here, but Hopefully everyone else found it as interesting or will find it as interesting as I did when it goes out. So, but Mark's promised to come back again. So, Susan, we'll have to find some other angle on this and get you both back.
I'm sure we will. Time will tell, but I'm sure we will.
Answer some questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
No problem. Cheers.
Thanks a million. Bye.
Bye.